I'm going to attempt to summarize what we did yesterday in 5 minutes, a couple minutes. Okay, so we first started off with the free particle, non-relativistic, and we wrote the action like this. And then we wanted to parameterize Q and T in terms of S, so we rewrote the action like this, where prime was d by ds. To get our primary constraint, we varied the action with respect to Q prime and T prime, and arrived at this as our primary constraint, PT plus PQ squared over 2m equals 0. To calculate our gauge orbits, we use our primary constraint. So our gauge orbits are in terms of our what we parameterize with respect to, so S. So df by ds is the Poisson bracket of f with our primary constraint. And so f, we had q, t, pq, and pt. And these were the differential equations which we were able to arrive at. And from these differential equations, we solved for pq, t, pq, and, or, yeah, sorry, no, we solved for q, t, PQ, and PT, and then we found our Dirac observables, and there were two independent ones. Okay, so that was the first half. Basically. And then the second part, the more focused part, was doing the Dirac program. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to find a space for our variables. Yes, phase space variables that satisfy this relation from the Poisson bracket to the commutator. So then the next section was to promote the constraints in our kinematic Hilbert space to Hermitian operators, and then characterize our space, our physical Hermitian space, characterize space solutions in physical Hilbert space, and then find a complete set of gauge invariant observables. So for part A, so we had Q, T, PQ, PQ, and PT, and we need to change them into their operators. So we just did the usual. Q goes to Q hat is Q, T hat is T. And then PQ and PT are the momentum operators with respect to the variable of the momentum that we're looking at. Now that we know what P, Q hat, and PT hat, we could rewrite what our constraint was. And that's what we did here. So we get this, which is just the Schrodinger equation, which is what we expected because we were dealing with the free particle. So
our solution was this.
Now, if we looked at the inner product of this psi 1 and psi 2, it blew up because we had an integral with respect to time, and we were independent of time, so the time just blew up. So then, that was for our kinematic Hilbert space. Now, when we went to our physical Hilbert space, time was fixed, and we only had to deal with an integral over dq, and this doesn't blow up, and t is fixed. Thank you.
And then our two independent observables, our two gauge independent observables were times t hat minus t naught. So one was q hat minus pq hat m over m times t hat minus t naught. And our second one was just pq hat. And then since I'm the teacher today, you guys should have shown this. There you go.
Okay, great. So,
want to erase this now?
No, you can leave it right now. Thanks. Okay, so indeed, yesterday we implied this Dirac program on a much simpler case than what we're going to do now, which was this parametrized particle. But it was the kind of simplest example for a totally covariant system. And now the aim of the course and the next few lectures is to apply this program now to 3D Euclidean gravity with, again, their cosmological constant. And so for today, what we're going to do, we're going to start. So you see that this Dirac program is applying the canonical quantization procedure. So the first step is to do this Hamiltonian analysis of your system. Okay, understand what are the constraints of your system, are they first class or not, and then we can. So before going to quantum, we need at least one or even two lectures to study the system of interest at the classical level and do this canonical analysis. So the starting point is going to be an action for gravity. So you're all familiar with the Einstein-Hilbert action. Then I guess in gravitational physics, I don't know if all of you took gravitational physics, but you should have seen the triad and spin connection formulation. So we'll go through again together, in particular in the specific case of 3D gravity. So did all of you take gravitational physics? One. OK, almost. We have some half, OK. But yeah, we're going to use the variables we're going to use. And then I think I won't have time today to do the canonical analysis of the system, but we'll start. And today already, we're going to see why 3D is much simpler, so even if I already mentioned it a bit. And yeah, the fact that it's Euclidean, we're going to see that if we wanted to do Lorentzian, it would change the gauge group. So here, as I already mentioned, we're going to have a SU2 gauge group. It will be Euclidean in 3D. It will be a SU11, so then it's a non-compact group, so things are more complicated. And not so well defined for all the objects we will consider. And then zero cosmological constant is because, so at least the proposal in 3D to add a cosmological constant is to work with quantum groups. So again, it's add kind of a layer of complexity. So let's stay with SU2 here and 3D gravity. OK, so the action that you should all be. So now we really start talking about gravity. Is that just a phone? Or is it an alarm something?
Is it on?
I don't really know where this comes from.
I think it's simple.
Yeah, no.
Okay, so now we know. Good, so we don't have to go out. That's a good news, I guess.
Like a really mellow way.
Yeah,
you should. Really bring down.
Don't panic. Yeah, but I think for people not to panic, it would be maybe a more efficient way to. Okay, so let's now look at action for gravity. And so let's start from the one you all know, even in 4D. So 1 over kappa, here kappa is just a constant in terms of the Newton constant and C, so I'm not going to define it. Then it's just the Ricci scalar, and here we have the determinant of the metric. And let's first consider 4D case, where, so here, this is a functional of the metric field or the inverse of the metric. And what you can do, so here really the fundamental field is the metric, okay? And here what you can do is look at the equation of motion by varying your action with respect to the inverse metric. And then what you get is that g mu nu, which is equal to okay, we're considering action. Yeah, we're in the vacuum. Okay, we don't have any matter here, so we just get this very simple equation, and this is equivalent to say, so these are the Einstein equation. This is equal to zero. So do you see how we prove this equivalence very quickly? How do you do that? Any suggestion?
You just try to say
R is zero. Okay, and so this is going to be valid as soon as the dimension of your space-time is greater than 2. Okay, because otherwise you don't get anything. Okay, so yeah, indeed here, this is valid even in 3D, in fact. And so it's a good exercise to find the equation of motion starting from the action and just doing the variation. Usually one way is to use Riemann coordinates to compute some of the term. So I let you do that as an exercise. I'm not going to do it. So here, in fact, I put 4, but whatever is the dimension, it's still working in 3D. And we still get the same equation here. So what is the fundamental physical difference between general relativity in 3D and in 4D? And so this is going to be to originate in the fact that now the curvature tensor in 3D is just going to depend linearly in the Ricci tensor. Okay? So what does it mean? That means that the fact that this is equal to zero in 3D, so this is really now in 3D, because we have a linear dependence, is going to imply that and so from this equation, we see that in 3D, every solution of the vacuum Einstein equation is going to be flat. Okay, the curvature tensor is going to be zero. And here, maybe we can convince ourselves that we are not missing any kind of degrees of freedom going from here to here. So let's just do kind of a counting of the number of independent component in the Riemann and Ricci tensors, okay? So maybe let's do that together. So let's start with, just to convince yourself if I haven't done any really calculation here. So what are the property of this object? Is first, you know that it's antisymmetric. In the first two indices. So how many, so here all these indices can take 3 value, okay, run from 0 to 1 to 3. So how many symmetric pairs do we get here? So if it's antisymmetric in the first two indices, how many independent? So it's symmetric, so usually when you have symmetric, you say that it's, but n is equal to 3 here, okay? So for n equals 3. Okay, we can do, what is the other property? Is that it's also anti-symmetric? In the last two indices. And so again, we have the same calculation. So here, this last two indices could be almost seen as one index running from 1 to 3. And what other property do we have? Is that it's symmetric in the exchange, under exchange of the first pair with the second pair, okay? So symmetric. First pair, second pair. Okay, so how do you get, how many symmetric pairs do we get? So each, here it's like from 1 to 3, from 1 to 3. So here how many indices do we, independent component do we get at the end? So since it's symmetric, you know that you get this with n still equal to 3. So you get 6 independent components. In 3D. Okay, and if now you look at the Ricci tensor, which is also symmetric, and each of these components can take 3 values, you also get 6 components. Okay, so this is just to kind of convince you that indeed in 3D things really simplify. You don't lose any kind of degrees of freedom here. Okay, so this is why 3D gravity is so simple, okay? There is no, every solution is going to be, so if we were adding a cosmological constant, then it would be that every solution would have a constant curvature, but here every solution is flat. So physically in 3D, we don't have any local degrees of freedom. And we say that 3D is a topological theory, okay? So here, because we have, so here, only all solutions are flat, okay, the vacuum. And 3D gravity magical theory. So, no local degrees of freedom.
So that means, topological means that there's like no dynamics or anything like that, or what does?
So here it is going to mean that all the global degrees are just going to be, so there is no, so for example in 3D, we don't have any, so graviton. Okay, we don't expect any.
It's like graviton.
No, but there is no local degrees of freedom, so we don't expect any things to propagate if you want. But in, so this means that all the degrees of freedom you can get are going to be global, and it's just going to depend on the topology of your manifold. Okay. So for example, the example we're going to do at the end when we're going to quantize, we're going to choose the simplest object we can get, so we're going to consider just a sphere to as our space, our space. But yeah, so then the topology is going to be trivial here, so we not expect any degrees of freedom. So at the end, we're just going to get one physical state. Okay. But so yeah, here, so if your space-time is topologic trivial, then you don't have any gravitational degrees of freedom at all. Okay, so this is, at the end, what we're going to quantize here. We're not going to quantize much. We're going to quantize in the course. We're going to quantize a space-time with a trivial topology, so no gravitational degrees of freedom. And so how do you characterize the topology of your manifold? It's characterized by what we call the fundamental group. Okay, I don't know if you, which roughly speaking is going to count the number of topologically distinct closed curves on a given manifold. So for example, on a plane, any curve can be deformed into another one without breaking. And so we say that the fundamental group has only one element and is trivial in this case. If now your spacetime has a non-trivial fundamental group or a non-trivial topology, then we will have a finite number of degrees of freedom that are going to remain, but are going to be global degrees of freedom. Okay. So in 3D, you can decompose. So 3D, in the cases we're going to be interested, our manifold can be always decomposed R time a 2D surface. And the topology of 2D, so here it's. The topology of 2D surfaces is classified. And in particular, any orientable, so we're going to focus on orientable surfaces, is this is classified topology before. And yeah, so any 2D orientable surface is homomorphic to either a sphere or the connecting sum of some tori. Okay, so any orientable. You cannot read, is that?
Yeah. It's classified on the.
Yeah, classified, yeah, sorry. The expression of your. Either so a sphere and it's the case we're going to consider in our case, but otherwise it can be all to the connected sum of G. Tori. So tori is a plural of torus. And the number of G here is going to be the genus of your surface. So of course, a sphere has genus zero. And we're going to see that the two sphere has a trivial fundamental group because any loop is contractible. Okay. Now, if you consider a flat torus can be obtained if you start with just a piece of paper like this, and you're going to say to identify this side with this side and this side with this side. Okay, the way you get a torus, or it's also what you could call a donut, I guess. It's quite similar in term of shape. And here the fundamental group is non-trivial, and you will get. So if you now look at the kind of equation of motion, you will get, it's going to tell you. So if you look at gravity on a torus, the equation of motion are going to tell you how the lengths of these curves are going to evolve. And so you have for a torus, you have two non-contractible, so how do you draw these things? Like this, I guess. So you have one curve this way, and you have another one this way, and so it's going to be characterized by two global parameters that are going to be the length of these two curves. Okay. So in our case, we're going to focus again on the C+ topology. So you can add kind of complexity in your problem by choosing a more complex topology, but here we're going to focus just on the sphere. Okay. Okay, so this was just why 3D gravity is so simple. It's because every solution of the vacuum Einstein equation are flat. Okay, so the curvature tensor is zero, and it's what we call a topological theory. Okay, so now let's see, as I mentioned in the first day in the introduction, if we stay with the metric variable, our fundamental variable, then we don't really know how to apply the Dirac programs, okay? Because if you do this, you can of course perform the canonical analysis. This is the IDM formalism. But then the constraint you get, so you get constraint, of course, that classically everything is well defined. But the constraint, again, are non-polynomial in your variable, so in your metric variable. And then as operators, we don't really know how to write this, okay? So here we're going to see that things kind of simplify, or also, even if the constraint have kind of a complicated expression sometimes, we see that our constraints have a nice kind of geometrical interpretation. So usually we also go around by imposing them in a different way. Yeah. Okay, so let's move to the first order formalism of 3D gravity. So this is, any questions here?
First order. Question?
Yeah.
Does this classification include R2?
You're asking if it's only for compact surfaces or, here it's for, Okay, so the metric, so here this action is written in terms of the metric. This is the gravitational field, and it's going to encode all the geometry of the manifold. But what we're going to do here is that the metric can also be seen as the kind of the pullback of the Minkowski metric to the tangent space if we introduce some orthonormal frame. So let me write it explicitly, and then we're going to discuss what is the meaning of these frames here. And this is at each point, so I should put an X here because it's really at each point of the manifold that this is valid, okay? So here we get this. And because here I'm talking about Euclidean metric, what I call Minkowski metric is in fact just here delta function, okay? Otherwise, of course, I would get a difference between and so that's why in our case, I will be sometimes a bit lazy about up and down indices for the what we call the internal indices, okay? Because it's going to be raised or lower by using this just delta function. So there is no really issue of chain, of sign and everything, okay? So now that this means that at each point, so here it's also at each point, you have a kind of orthonormal frame, okay? And you can, if you look at the orthonormality relation here, what I wanted to say. So here, Ni can take the value from, so this could be introduced in any dimension, okay? Then you call this object brain, I guess. But so in our case, it's just from 1 to 3. Okay. And then it's a triad. In 4 dimension, you call that a tetrad. And so now by acting with the metric, we can define the co-triad. Okay. So the co-triad is just you take this equation, we're going to contract it with mu j, and then you will define the co-triad as okay, and this is the co-triad. Okay, so these are triad and co-triad. So now, let's do the simple counting of degrees of freedom. So here, mu is a space-time indices, but in 3D, so it's from 3. And this is a symmetric tensor, okay? So again, how many degrees of freedom do we have, or independent indices do we have here? We have 6, okay, because it's a symmetric. So here we have 6 if we look at the number kind of what they call degrees of freedom here. And how many do we get here? What is this?
3 by 3.
Sorry?
3 by 3, 9.
Yeah, very good. So here, 9. So you see that by going from the metric to the triad, we introduce kind of some irrelevant information here. Okay. So, and can you see what, which kind of, what is the additional? So we indeed going to get an additional gauge symmetry. So do you see what is the additional gauge symmetry that we get here?
Is it just like rotation at all?
Yeah. Okay. So here, as I said, this is a small frame at each point. And now at each point, you can indeed rotate your frame. And we, you can check that if you now define of x, where this is a SO3 rotation here. So here I'm talking about SO3, and we're going to see that at the end we're going to talk about SO2, so we have to clarify why we can do that and why it is useful. And so we have this additional SO3 gauge symmetry. And you can check that indeed with now R is just a, it's an exercise. Check that this transformation indeed let the metric unchanged. Okay. Check that transform okay, very good. So now instead of the metric, we can work with the triad. However, we see that now this triad has this kind of new indices that is this carries this additional index, which is an internal index, in addition to the space-time one. Okay, so usually in the curve space-time to do vector analysis, okay, what you need a metric, but also a connection. Okay. And in general, for Riemann geometry, so in general relativity, the connection is torsion-free and metric-compatible. And in this case, then the metric is completely and uniquely determined by the metric, and it's the so-called Levi-Civita connection. Okay, and so then you know from GR that the Levi-Civita connection is going to be used to define the standard covariant derivative. And this covariant derivative is needed to parallel transport space-time tensor to make sure that, so yeah, you use your covariant derivative to transport a space-time tensor. And what is important about this derivative is to make sure that the covariant derivative of a tensor is a tensor itself. Okay, so this is the property you want. But so now we don't only have this kind of space-time indices, we also have our internal indices. So this means that as what we need, we also need a connection that allows us to connect neighboring points on our space-time, okay? But we also need a connection to connect some points in the internal space, okay? And this is what we're going to need, what we call a spin connection. Okay, so what we want, it's very similar to usually what you have in general relativity, but in general relativity, you only have. Okay, so here, now we want to parallel transport. So here it's what we're going to need, the spin connection. And you want to parallel transport objects with internal indices. as for the Levi-Civita connection, so the point was to have a covariant derivative. So the covariant derivative was to transport space-time tensor, but also to ensure that covariant derivative of a space-time tensor is still a space-time tensor. So here we also want to ensure the proper transportational behavior. Under internal rotation. So now for the covariant derivative of object with internal indices. So the covariant object with internal indices. So the connection associated to this covariant derivative, so here we need to define a new kind of covariant derivative, is going to be what we call the spin connection. Okay, so here, to define this new covariant derivative, we need the spin connection. With ik are internal indices and mu is a space-time index, okay? And so let's define the covariant derivative for space-time scalar covector with internal index and okay, so here I want to I'm going to give you that, and then we're going to talk about if this spin connection can be defined just in terms of the usual connection, you know, the Levi-Civita connection. Okay, because again, the Levi-Civita connection is really special because since you ask that your connection is torsion-free and metric compatible, just asking these two characteristics make that your connection is totally determined by your metric. Okay, so here, is it this a new object, or do we need to add some constraint on it to, in order that this is determined in terms of the Levi-Civita connection? So we're going to see that. And do we have some conditions that can be relaxed in the first order action? So meaning, yeah, so we're going to study that. But first, let me give you what is this covariant derivative. So now this object is a vector for internal indices, but it's a scalar for the space-time index, and this is just going to be defined this way. We can do something very similar. Now, if it's a covector for the internal index, and it's just going to change the sign here. So I let you check that my summation of index is correct. And now if I use an object which is a vector for the internal space, but a covector in space-time, then I get something where I need to mix the Levi-Civita connection. So here I have mu, which is going to be contracted with okay, I know what is the issue. I have twice the same index here. So it's not really going to work. Mu, nu, and then, oh, Okay, so this, but then since I have also internal index, I need to add this term. Okay. Mu. Okay. Okay, so I let you check that I'm okay with all these indices because on the blackboard usually you don't see much. And to work a bit with that as an exercise, I let you check that this definition of the covariant derivative, if now the derivative if you just look at the derivative of a scalar, by scalar I mean scalar for the internal index here, okay? That what you get, you just get, is just the ordinary derivative, partial derivative, okay? Okay, so let's now look at so what we want now is that this covariant derivative is compatible with so I'm going to denote so this is the new covariant so the new covariant derivative is defined like this, okay? And we want to make the connection with the covariant derivative for the Levi-Civita connection. So here, the covariant derivative, I'm just going to use this notation, okay? So, so what is the relation between this object and the Levi-Civita connection, and are these two derivatives compatible? Okay, so this is what we want to check. And also we're going to see that if we add, maybe it's, we need to add a kind of compatibility condition. So any questions here? Okay, so yeah, I'm just going to finish with this technical part, but it's good that you get familiar with playing with these two kind of indices around, because then tomorrow we're really going to start working on the first order action and study the symmetries of this action and everything. So we're going to use this a lot. So I know that this part is not super exciting, but we need to make sure that everyone is on the same page. So now we're going to see that. So what we demand now is this compatibility condition. So we're going to add. And we're going to see that adding this compatibility condition is nice for two different aspects. So we want that the derivative annihilates the triad. And just adding this compatibility condition, the spin connection now is going to be completely determined by the Levi-Civita connection and the triad, okay? Oh. And also, why also is it nice? It's because of this. So how is the triad or co-triad going to be used? The triad or co-triad is going to be used to define, so we're going to start with all the objects you know in generality are defined in terms of just have space-time indices, okay? And so now we're going to see that we're going to work with objects that have this additional internal index. And the way you go from a space-time object to an object with internal indices is by contracting with this triad or cotriad. Okay? And yeah, it's the kind of things we did here. We contracted this with this object, and we defined here the cotriad. But so you can do that for any kind of object. So what is nice about this compatibility condition is because we have this means that now you can apply the covariant derivative now is going to commute with the contraction with the triad or cotriad. Okay? And so what does it mean? This means that if you have a space-time object and you transform it as a kind of internal object, then you can take the covariant derivative on it, or you can already take the covariant derivative on just your space-time object and then contract it to define your thing, and these are equivalent. Okay? So this is kind of nice here is that we get this, that here, in addition to allow us to determine completely the spin connection in terms of what is what you know, it also allow us to kind of have this nice relation. Okay? So now this makes sure that the derivative commutes with the contraction. Okay. So this is one first aspect, but the other aspect is really that now your spin connection. And I'm not going to, so you can just expand that. And you can show that this equation just gives you that the spin connection can be defined in terms of the usual covariant derivative, the space-time covariant derivative, defined in terms of the Levi-Civita. So here, what we get if we write this explicitly, and how do you get this equation? You really just expand this using the definition I gave here, of the last line, more or less. And then you just contract this line with, again, a cotriad here. Okay? And so let me finish to write this. So here, this means that spin connection is determined by the Levi-Civita connection and the triad.
Actually, the last J is supposed to be a K, right?
Okay, so here it's where we need to check
the last indexable, right? Because you have two J's in the last term.
But here also, here also I have
it's a K2, probably.
Oh, yeah, if you mean here.
Yes, but you.
Then.
No,
here it's a K. You want, it's two. The spin connection has two internal indices. So this was wrong first, but maybe it's not the only mistake I did here.
In the last term, you still have like two J's? Upper J's?
Here. So here I have one. Where do I have two?
Oh, it's a new? Okay, great. Okay. What is that?
Yeah, new.
Ah, okay, great. Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes.
So let's check. So we're supposed to have just JK mu as free index. So here, Q, J, K, mu, J, should be fine. Okay, so yeah, it's really just this equation that you contract with a cotriad here, okay? And you get the right result. Okay, so this is so to really understand what are the property of this omega, let's kind of take the other approach and say that conversely, we can also define a connection using this equality. So we can, this is invertible, so we can define a connection like this. And the idea now is to see if we require that this connection is the Levi-Civita connection, meaning that it's metric compatible and torsion free, what are the conditions we get on this one? Okay, so let's just write the inverse of this. So again, you will have to check for my indices J mu K mu plus mu mu, I guess. Mu, okay. Okay, so this is just inverting. So now, what are the conditions? The question we ask are, what are the conditions on omega that this new connection is just the Levi-Civita connection? And so here, what we want to impose on this is that it's metric compatible and torsion free. So let me just define a new object. In fact, we're going to work often with, instead of this one, we're going to use, so for internal index, the metric is just the delta function. So it's what we use to lower. Let me first define this object as L mu k delta L j. So if we impose the metric condition on, so metric condition, the fact that it's metric compatible, the metric compatibility condition, compatible, meaning that we want, if now I denote the covariant derivative associated to this one this way, so what this is going to imply, to see that, we're going to impose that on, we're going to compute this object. And again, you're going to see that this is really just playing with. Okay, so what is that? Here, oh, sorry. So I'm mixing indices, so rho. Okay, so what is inside here my bracket? Can you see that? Again, it's really, again, we're using the triad to go to the internal space. So the metric is only space-time indices, but what we do we get here? We just get the internal metric that in our case is just the delta here. So here you know that this is equal to zero just because of this. But if now we expand this, it's a product of three things, and we use the compatibility metric, what we get here is that this object, we get the condition on the spin connection, which is going to tell you. So here you can just expand that. So here you need to use the metric compatibility. So what you get is really mu kj. Okay, so what does it mean here? This means that the metric compatibility on this object is going to impose that the spin connection has to be antisymmetric. So this object is antisymmetric. Okay, so here, this impose and now if you use the fact that this is antisymmetric, you can use it to show that now your new covariant derivative, so this one, is metric. And this imposes that d mu is metric, meaning that it's going to annihilate the internal metric, which is just this one. This is quite obvious. So meaning this is also metric. Metric compatible. Okay, then very quickly, because running out of time, if now we use the fact that this one is, we want to impose that it's torsionless, okay, it's torsion free. So meaning that it means that this is just symmetric under the two last indices. What we get, so I'm not going to do the calculation here. So the torsion free condition is going to be equivalent. So on this one is going to be equivalent to say that omega is also torsion free. And so what does it mean in terms of an equation here? It just means that this, and we're going to come back to this object, so I'm giving it to you now. The torsion is equal to zero. So here it's antisymmetric in this indices plus omega j mu k minus mu k j e k nu. So now my just concluding remark here is that in the first order formulation, what we're going to use of gravity, we'll consider connection. So in the first order formulation, we're going to use a connection JK antisymmetric in JK. But a priori, the torsion of this object is not going to vanish a priori. And it's just going to appear as just an equation of motion. Okay, so you see that you kind of have maybe more freedom here with torsion is, so does not vanish a priori. And we will see that this is just going to appear as an equation of motion. OK, so now we're ready. We have all the tools to write the first order action for gravity and do the canonical analysis. So this is what we're going to do tomorrow. So here was maybe a bit technical, but tomorrow we are going really to start from what is the action written in terms of this variable for gravity and do the canonical analysis and try to figure out what are the constraints, what are the meaning also of the constraint, and yeah, so.